Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current version of my Sunday sermon. And like last week, this is a day early. I'm recording this on Thursday instead of Friday, which means that the sermon might change quite a bit between now and Sunday. We've been going through the book of Romans in our adult Sunday school class, and Paul is writing to the church at Rome, and he says this: I am obligated both to Greeks and non-Greeks, both to wise and foolish. That is why I am so eager to preach the gospel also to you who are in Rome. Rome was very much seen to be the center of the world in many ways. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. And a lot of people believe that that last verse, verse 16, is the thesis statement of the book. The idea that there is sort of a direction in history in which God works to redeem the world. And the people of God have been struggling with the pace and the manner of God's movement pretty much right from the beginning. The story of Israel is in many ways the foundation of the story of the Bible. There's exile from the garden. There's a world drowned by the flood. There's the promise made to Abraham. There's enslavement in Egypt. There's rescue. And yet, the generation that is rescued died in the desert, and their children inherit the promised land. And then when they're in the promised land, they're perpetually and cyclically enslaved. God delivers them. They forget. They become enslaved. Back around and around, and you can read about that in the book of Judges. The story in some ways reaches its peak during the reign of David and Solomon. The Philistines are put down, but even in that period, there are two pretty vicious civil wars, one between Saul and David after Saul's death, between Saul's men and David's men, and the other over Absalom, David's son, who tries to take the kingdom from him. Then you've got this period of a divided kingdom, which has very messy kingships, and prophets are sent, and most often unheard. Then, of course, you have the Babylonian destruction of the temple and the exile, and a remnant returns with the coming of the Persian Empire, and the temple is rebuilt, but it is not the same. There are many amazing prophecies about what would happen when God restores his people and the kingdom, but the reality under Persia and then under Greece and then under Rome, the Maccabean revolt notwithstanding, always sort of seemed like twilight as compared to the bright light of day, as was imagined by many of the prophecies. And so after the rebuilding of the temple under the Persian Empire, many wondered, is this all there is? Is this all God is going to do? The book of Malachi, now Malachi basically means my messenger, so there's always a debate as to whether that's the name of the prophet or it's just simply my messenger. The book of Malachi, this is a short summary from really a handy little book, How to Read the Bible Book by Book, has nice little book summaries that can help you figure out what's in a book pretty quickly. Malachi's oracle comes by way of six disputes between the Lord and his people, all having the same root cause. In a time of spiritual disillusionment, Israel has grown weary of the Lord and keeping his covenant. The dispute comes in two sets of three. The first takes up the basic issue, their complaint that the Lord does not love them, and the Lord's complaint that they have shown contempt for him. In the second set, the Lord twice takes up their complaint that he has done nothing about evil and injustice. These two bracket the Lord's exposing their own forms of injustice. At the same time, they affirm that the great day of the Lord will indeed come. And we've talked about this day of the Lord. And as we begin the Christian New Year, the day of the Lord is right there on our minds and lips and in our imaginations. At the same time, they affirm the great day of the Lord will indeed come. The book concludes with words about the law, Moses, and the prophets, Elijah. Now, this week on my YouTube channel, I did some work on Christian deconstruction. One Christian musician says, you know, if there is a God, why can't we see him? as if God is just another being within the world. And we talked about that when we talked about the metadivine realm a few weeks ago. If there is a God, why is there so much evil? There's a perennial question that Christianity has to wrestle with, because in fact we believe that this world is a world that was created good by God. If God is our Father, why would he let his children suffer? We know that other good earthly fathers keep their children from suffering. Why doesn't he answer my prayers whenever I need them? And so a lot of people wrestling with these kinds of issues, some of them giving up on the faith. That's in some ways analogous to what we see sort of in the book of Malachi. Maybe people who haven't quite given up on the faith formally or nominally, but have pretty much walked away and maybe are simply going through the motions. Now, we've also talked in the last number of sermons about the day of the Lord and sort of the fractal nature of the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord comes when the doctor says you have cancer. The day of the Lord comes when the person that you're interested in says, yes, I will marry you. The day of the Lord comes when there's a car accident or a job is lost. The day of the Lord comes with the birth of a new child or a temple dedication. The day of the Lord is a very interesting moment of revelation where all the mundane things of the world sort of disappear and everything is seen in stark reality. And this can be very large, major things. COVID-19 sort of exposed the way we imagined we had control of history and control of the world, and no, we don't. And this is often why the Revelation, the last book of the Bible, is in Greek, it's apocalypse. It's a revealing. It's a revelation of the way things are. That's what the day of the Lord is. And there will be a definitive day of the Lord that is promised throughout the Bible when history as we know it will end in a very large way, but that fractals all the way down into the small things of our life. And so, in some senses, all of the days of the Lord are pre-echoes of that day. For Israel in 586 BC, it was the day of the Lord. For every nation and empire, their nation comes to an end and their empire comes to an end. For each of our lives, we are born and we die. And for the little episodes of our lives, the little chapters. Malachi 2:17, right at the heart of the book, you have wearied the Lord with your words. How have we wearied him, you ask? By saying, all who do evil in the eyes of the Lord, all who do evil are good in the eyes of the Lord, and he is pleased with them. Where is the God of justice? Well, what do they mean by that? This is a common refrain in the Old Testament that the wicked flourish. Where is God? Morality doesn't seem to pay off in this world. Where is God? The same issue that's been brought up in the book of Job. I will send my messenger who will prepare the way for me. Then suddenly the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple. The messenger of the covenant whom you desire will come, says the Lord Almighty. And we can imagine what filled their imaginations, probably not something terribly different than if you had told the Greeks, Plato will ride his golden chariot down from the skies and appear at his temple, and he will strike down all of his enemies, and all those who are loyal, who have given sacrifices to him, will be raised up and rewarded for their faithfulness. We have those same expectations today. You can't watch the Marvel movies and not see these demigods. And now I found this little GIF on the internet. Is it GIF or GIF? It's GIF on the internet, which brought in all the DC comic movies too. And so you got Wonder Woman and Captain America running together. These are muscular, powerful demigods coming to battle aliens from space who are to wipe out humanity with a snap of their fingers, right? All these same dreams. We still have them today. David finally subduing their neighbors, the Maccabees throwing off the yoke of the Greeks, but the yoke keeps coming back. And the Maccabees, well, the Hasmonean dynasty was a bit of a mess. And in their intramural squabbles, well, let's get Rome on our side. And Rome came and Rome stayed. But who can endure the day of his coming? Who can stand when he appears? For he will be like a refiner's fire or a launderer's soap. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. He will purify the Levites, that's the tribe who are the priests, and refine them like gold and silver. Then the Lord will have men who will bring offerings in righteousness, and the offerings of Judah and Jerusalem will be acceptable to the Lord as in the days gone by, as in former years. There's the vision, there's the dream. But right there you can notice in the vision and the dream, the tensions. Do we really want God coming to purify? Don't we like sort of the shadows in the corner where we can get our desires met and do as we want and not have the bright light of God shining in with his moral purity? Jesus will be a disturbing surprise. He will not come down. Even Satan tempts him. Jump off the pinnacle of the temple. Let them see angels. Then they'll worship you. Jesus is far smarter than that. He knows our hearts. He knows that the religious show or the possibility of power seduces us and not in the right way. Miraculous power, okay, for a start. But when Jesus did that in the Galilee, again and again you'll read in the Gospels, you're not understanding what I'm doing. You want to consume me, but you don't want to be refined by me. He's tough on disciples and leaders. He's kind to the type of people who seem to be wobbly in the effort to resist Rome. And that puts him on the bad side of many others who wanted him to be a zealous Maccabean figure. He's killed by the Romans, offered up by his own people to the Romans. And his followers say he has risen and ascended, but skeptics still doubt. Malachi 3:5. So I will come and put you on trial. I will be quick to testify against sorcerers, adulterers, and perjurers, against those who defraud laborers of their wages, who oppress the widows and the fatherless, who deprive the foreigner among you of justice. But do not fear me, says the Lord. He doesn't fit into our boxes. We have some people that say, well, public morality is where everything is at. Private morality is up to me. And others that say, private morality is the foundation of a society. Public morality will follow. He demands both private righteousness and public justice, and nothing short of perfection. And we usually like to sort of favor one over the other. But he again will confuse Israel, because in his first coming was not to bring justice, but to bear justice. And so he dies, is risen, and ascends. Now some understanding, we should have some understanding for the struggle of the post-exilic pre-Jesus. They had read the prophecies. Jerusalem, not doing so well. They were surrounded by Samaritans, people who were sort of a mixture, had their own new Bible. God's people trying to figure out how to make life work. Why doesn't God just come in like Apollo and with his arrows and smite the wobbly and smite the wicked and uphold those who are moral and righteous? Well, the problem with the moral and righteous are they are often self-righteous, and that's not what he's looking for either. We are also between revelations, the first coming and the second coming. Don't despair, Jesus encourages. Don't flag in zeal. Don't give up. What we're seeing in all of this is sort of the evolution of our relationship with our God. We often begin imagining it's do right and be rewarded, do wrong and be punished. Yeah, there is some of that. But how right can you do? Can you actually fulfill the law? Can you actually, in public and private, be the righteous person that God needs? Righteousness is delivered to us. Misery, deliverance, gratitude. We are miserable. We are rescued. We live out grateful obedience. It sort of begins as a karmic, transactional relationship with God. We try to use God to get what we want. We obey or sacrifice in order to achieve or preserve. With Job and Jesus, we see it isn't quite so clear like that. Yet though he slay me, Job says. But Job is going to have a lot more to say. He's going to struggle all throughout that book. Jesus in the garden, Father, forgive them. Father, if there may be another way that this cup may pass from me. And then on the cross, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. We want God for God, not what he can do for us. That's finally where we go, the evolution of our relationship with God. And he wants us for us. And we see what it will cost him. And we offer ourselves for him and his kingdom. And we love a world that does not deserve our love or his love. And we give because he first gave to us. These are nice words and nice thoughts, but we practice and embody them in the meal. He gives himself for us as our very food. We take him into us, and we become like him. We together become one body. We together become one body, his witness to the world.